Welcome to the second episode of the Fisheries Podcast. Today I interview Dr. Quentin Phelps, and we discuss what is fisheries management and describe some of the key terms. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. Today, we are joined by the first guest ever to come on the Fisheries Podcast, Dr. Quentin Phelps. Quentin received his bachelor's and master's degree in wildlife and fisheries science from South Dakota State University in 2003 and 2006. He then went on to earn his PhD in zoology with a specialization in fisheries science from Southern Illinois University in 2011. After that, he spent time working for the Missouri Department of Conservation as a systems ecologist and adjunct professor at Southeast Missouri State University. He currently is employed as an assistant professor of wildlife and fisheries at West Virginia University. Quinn has close to 100 publications in both popular articles and scientific journals covering a variety of topics from precision of five structures for estimating age of common carp to the speed difference between cleaning fish with an electric knife versus the Old Faithful. He is not just a success on paper. Quinn has starred in a handful of YouTube videos on filleting silver carp, but perhaps his largest role came when he appeared on Andrew Zimmern's Bizarre Foods. And as you would guess, he is one of the players behind the Asian Carp Feast featured at AFS 146 in Kansas City. With all that said, I welcome the man himself, Dr. Quinn Phelps. How have you been?
Good, man. That was a really good introduction. Thank you for all that. A lot of really nice things that you said there. And before we get started, all those good things that you said would certainly not have been possible without the many scientists and graduate students, undergraduate students that I've had sort of side by side, and my mentors and advisors through this whole process. So that's all I got to say there. Yeah, I'm doing great.
Well, I copied most of that off the internet because it sounds better than the original blurb I had written down that just said he was my master's advisor and he co-authored some papers with me.
Yeah, no, that was everything that you said there was really good. And thanks to you for being one of those parts in making all of that happen.
Oh, I didn't do too much of it.
That's really good. Nick, I've been very fortunate over the course of the last 20 years to be able to do some really good fishery science with a special emphasis in fisheries management, doing work for predominantly state agencies to answer specific management questions that are needed to promote sustainability of recreational and commercial fisheries.
Last week, I mentioned that I was thinking of inviting a non-fisheries person on each week's episode to make sure that science is coming through clear to a non-science person. So today, I would like to welcome my brother Jacob to the show. Jacob is not a fisheries professional, but he has helped me run gill nets before. How are you, Jacob?
Oh, I'm great, Nick. It's a few less credentials than Quentin, but I'm ready to give my insight as a non-fisheries member of society.
Your main job is to stop Quentin and I during the conversation at any point when you don't know what we're talking about or if you just have a question. So if we start talking too much science or if there's a term you don't know, just pipe in and we'll explain. Or if you come up with a question, just fire away, all right?
All right.
If you didn't listen to last week's episode, then you may not know that Quentin and I worked together for a few years on the Mississippi River while I was in grad school alongside a good crew of biologists and other graduate students like Quentin already alluded to, but now he's in West Virginia mentoring his next batch of students. And I have some questions of my own, but I reached out on Twitter and Facebook for other people to pipe in. And Dre Carl asked on Twitter, what are some new projects or questions you're excited to be tackling now that you're in West Virginia, Quentin?
Nick, really, it's a blend of the old school things that I was doing that I was very tied to when I was into the Midwest. We're still doing a lot of Mississippi River work, specifically looking at a vital rate of the various fishes in the Mississippi River. So looking specifically at, you know, recruitment, growth, mortality, doing adult-based age assessment. So very similar probably to what you were doing when you were a graduate student in the lab on paddlefish. You know, those are the basic processes to be able to manage fish populations. Given those information, we're able to use that to determine how many fish should be kept by the average recreational angler, what size of fish should be kept by those anglers. And then also, from more of an ecological perspective, is that it provides insight into the function of the river system. If we see that one of these vital rates is out of whack, it may indicate some form of habitat alteration. It may indicate that climate change is occurring. It may indicate some environmental perturbation is influencing the fish population. That sort of old hat, right? I mean, that's the bread and butter that I had when I was in the Midwest. The new stuff, even though that's, I'm not discrediting the old stuff at all, because it was all good stuff. We're learning a lot. But the new stuff, the newest thing, and probably one of the most exciting, is that I'm getting to work now with the West Virginia DNR. I have a lot of projects going on with them on the Ohio River, and then the subsequent tributaries associated with the Ohio, such as the Monongahela River and the Kanawha River. We're doing a lot of different fish species works that's of interest to the state. Of course, black bass is a big issue in West Virginia. We have a lot of recreational bass anglers that focus on bass on the Ohio, and there's a lot of interest there. So we're going to be beginning a black bass project to evaluate the dynamic rate functions, interact with some of our anglers, get their perspective on what's happening in that fishery, and then come up with management recommendations to hopefully bolster the black bass fishery in the Ohio River Basin, in the Ohio River and its tributaries. Paddlefish is another big one, just the same stuff that you were working on when you were a graduate student of mine down there in Missouri. We're doing some of that work as well. West Virginia has stocked a lot of paddlefish in the past, but just have not had the time or the manpower yet to be able to evaluate all of those previous stocking efforts. So we're going to be going out collecting adults, maybe putting some transmitters in fish in association with the Department of Natural Resources, and then aging some of those paddlefish to be able to get at those vital rates to really see if the paddlefish population in the Ohio River, at least adjacent to West Virginia, is self-sustaining. Another project that I'm working on is the catfish in our big rivers. So same spots that I was talking about with the black bass, channel catfish, flathead catfish, blue catfish, they're all prized by our recreational constituents here in West Virginia. So we're going to be beginning a project evaluating those populations. One other project that I'm really excited about with West Virginia DNR is that there are some smaller streams, maybe even some would call them wadeable rivers, is that we're going to be evaluating the smallmouth bass populations. There's a lot of folks that really like smallmouth bass fisheries, and there could be some potential effects of delayed mortality, which really what I'm talking about with delayed mortality is angling. You know, there's a lot of bass fishermen that believe solely that catch and release is a good thing, which for the most part it is. But maybe at various times of the year, that catch and release, even though you're catching and releasing the fish, there could be mortality to those individuals that are captured. Even though they're released, maybe they still die in the population. Those are the West Virginia DNR projects that are super cool, I think are going to be very informative to management. And then we're also working with the Virginia Department of Game and Inland Fisheries on a couple of things, and nothing set in stone yet, but one looking at some very high, one high elevation, a reservoir specifically focusing on smallmouth bass and brook trout, looking specifically at why the brook trout population in this lake really isn't doing quite as well as it has in the past. And then probably the one that most people will know is, of course, we're also working with John Odenkirk, which is a very famous snakehead guy with Virginia Department of Game and Inland Fisheries. And we're going to be doing some snakehead work over there, specifically evaluating what streams and tributaries are the most important within Virginia that are contributing snakeheads to the population. So really, really diverse set of projects. And then, of course, to go back to sort of my bread and butter, we're also working with various state agencies throughout the Ohio River. So Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife Resources, Indiana DNR, Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission, and then, of course, West Virginia DNR on Asian carp issues, specifically to evaluate where is the invasion front of the population. So specifically looking at where is the upstream most extent of the Asian carp population, and then also looking at where is reproduction and recruitment occurring. Those are very important to management because we need to know where those carp are so we can prevent any further upstream expansion from occurring. So those are the big picture projects. There are a lot of sub-projects going on within each of those. One that you'd find pretty cool, Nick, I think, because you've set some trot lines in your past. We're doing one project that's evaluating three different colors of a product called Zoat Soap, red or pink, blue, and white. And we're looking to see which one channel catfish would like to consume the most. And the reason that we're using soap to try to catch catfish is to reduce turtle bycatch. A lot of times with trot lines or with hoop nets, you can end up catching turtles. Turtles need to breathe. And one thing with, you know, traditional fishery sampling gear is that it can be devastating to turtle populations because the turtles can't come up for air. So we're trying to use baits that are going to deter or eliminate the turtles from consuming something that they would normally consume or normally be caught or used for catfish.
Sounds like you got your hands full there with all those projects.
There is a lot of really cool stuff going on, man. I think we've got a lot of very good projects. Even one more that it's a smaller project, but something that is, again, from the old school, from Missouri when I was working there, is that we're still working with the Fish and Wildlife Service and Missouri Department of Conservation as collaborators because, heck, we did so much work together from the past that, you know, we're still doing pallid sturgeon work in and around St. Louis. So it gives us the West Virginia University graduate and undergraduate students opportunities to go out and see a very different part of the country and a very different fishery.
Now, most of your projects kind of keyed around some of your primary interests, the population dynamics, fish movement patterns, life history attributes, trophic ecology, and stable isotope technology. Jacob, do you remember any of those terms from your school days, vocabulary lessons?
No.
Quentin, would you mind explaining some of those?
Those are all really good questions. So let's start with population dynamics. When we talk about population dynamics, we're talking about recruitment, growth, and mortality. And we're talking about that with respect to individuals within a population. So recruitment simply means the number of individuals that are coming into the population. Now, you might ask the question, why is that important to a fisheries management biologist? Well, if you don't have recruitment or you don't have new individuals coming into the system, eventually, as those old fish die via mortality, you're not going to have anything for your constituents or your anglers to fish for. That was recruitment with a little touch of mortality. Does that make sense to you, Jacob?
Yeah, and do you measure the dynamic rate, like number of fish per cubic feet of water? Does it depend on the size of the body of water?
So it's a good question. We actually don't measure it like that. We take a representative sample from the adult population. And what we typically do is we go out with, say, electrofishing. If electrofishing is the best way to catch the specific species of interest, which a lot of times it is, we'll go out and we'll catch a representative sample, generally somewhere between 150 to 200 individuals. And then from those individuals, we will get an age structure. And how we get at the age structure of the population, it's wide ranging of a bunch of different ways you can do it. But we typically remove a hard part off of the fish. So that could be something like a scale or an otolith or a fin ray or a fin spine. And then we bring that back to our laboratory. And then under a microscope, we prepare the structure. I'll spare you the details on that, but we prepare the structure. And then we can actually count the number of annuli on each one of those hard parts. And then that gives us an idea of the age structure. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so it's like similar. Counting the rings on a tree.
Exactly the same as counting the rings on a tree. So then once we put all of that information in, we can then go back and we can say, well, how many age one fish did you have? How many age two fish you had? How many age three fish did you have? How many X age fish did you have? And what we typically see is that there's generally some stair step decline in the number of individuals as you get older. It's not very similar to humans, but as humans get older, the number of individuals that are out there declines because of mortality. We can use the number of individuals that are in each one of those age classes as a surrogate or as an index to recruitment. So if you see that there's a lot of variation or a lot of deviation between age classes, that indicates that there is high recruitment variability. If there is low deviation or the numbers between age classes seem to be fairly consistent, then that would indicate that there is consistent recruitment going on in the population. If you have erratic or inconsistent recruitment where maybe we have missing age classes out there, then what we can do as fisheries management biologists is maybe manipulate the habitat that's out there to try to promote more consistent recruitment. Or we can do things like stocking or propagate fish and then stock them in those years when we would have poor recruitment. I think in terms of recruitment, recruitment is really a very important to a fisheries management biologist. All make sense to you?
Yeah.
Let's move on to growth for just a second here. So growth is, we're simply looking at how big a fish is at a given age. So just as we talked about before, we go out, collect a representative sample, and then we can measure each one of those fish for size or total length. And then what we can do is we can figure out how old that fish is, and then we can determine basically how fast those fish are growing. So we could look at the mean length of each age class. And that gives us an idea as fisheries management biologists how well these fish are growing. If the fish are growing slow, that should mean something to us as a biologist. If the fish are growing fast, that should mean something. But for example, if the fish are growing really slow, maybe that means that there's too many of them out there. There's inadequate prey. So we would need to do something as management biologists to try to bolster the prey abundance that's out there to get that growth rate up. If the growth rates are really, really slow, then maybe we need to do something more with habitat or manipulation of some environmental variable to try to promote a faster growth.
What kind of environmental variable would you try to adjust?
There's a lot of existing literature out there that shows that basically water level manipulation, and this could be, you know, in rivers or in lakes, can have substantial effects on the growth rates in the population. And there's a lot of our water bodies that are controlled by various agencies. And maybe as a management biologist, if you see that, you know, growth is slow or growth is fast, and you can relate that back to these flow regimes, whether it's in a lake or a river or in an impoundment, maybe you could discuss that with that agency to try to promote those years that have the best growth. Maybe that corresponds to really high water levels. And that's typically what we see, is that the years that have really high water levels, those are the years we're going to see the most growth because there's more resources available. I think that makes sense. See, you know, if there's a lot of food around, fish are going to grow quite well. you have more space available, the fish are going to grow well.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So the last one on that, and again, not to belabor this at all, but mortality is the last of the dynamic rate functions or the population dynamics that we talk about. That one's just simply looking at the number of individuals that are leaving the population. Mortality is really subdivided into two components, one being fishing mortality and the other being natural mortality. So if we see that mortality is excessive in a population, meaning that it's really high, maybe we employ some sort of size limit or creel limit to curb or to lower that mortality rate. And just as it is with recruitment, a very important part of the population and something that we really need to have to be able to provide guidance to the aquatic resources that we're managing to make sure that there's enough fish out there for commercial and recreational anglers to be able to harvest, if that's so what they choose.
Nick, you experienced some high mortality earlier this spring. A lake, a bunch of dead fish turned up on shore. You do anything to help stop that?
We had a crappie fish kill on Perry Reservoir. Is a isolated marina cove. All the fish had a disease that they just carry around with them all the time, and they got stressed out being in that protected marina cove with a warm spell came through and no wave action to bring in oxygen. So the low oxygen in that little cove caused the fish to all die off from that disease. That's something kind of a unplanned, something you can't really fix too much on a reservoir.
Yeah.
So what's cool with that is that, you know, if next year when Nick goes out and he does his population assessment and he's looking at the dynamic rate functions and he sees that, you know, that mortality was excessive, meaning that it's having a substantial negative effect on the population. Remember, he said this was just a small area of the lake. So unless it had a big effect, Nick probably is not going to have to do much in that situation because really, in the grand scheme of things, it probably didn't have much of an effect. So that specific example, if the mortality in that event was excessive, then Nick might have to go out there and maybe put some more fish in the place of those that died.
So would you continue to try to build the fish population there if you knew there was a high chance of that high kill rate?
I hate to answer that one, but this is a situation that's common in fisheries. And I think that our public, our constituents' view of, you know, seeing some fish dead on the shore, it does look very bad. But if you take a step back and instead of looking at an individual tree within the forest, to actually look at the forest, I think that, you know, these minor mortality events, really in the grand scheme, unless it's a substantial portion of the lake or reservoir, river, whatever it is that you're dealing with, probably not a big deal. So there are fish do die, and that's something that we do as fisheries managers have to deal with, and we just have to really focus in on whether or not the mortality event was excessive.
For those unfamiliar with the field of fisheries science, management goals might seem obtainable on smaller impoundments like ponds. What about on larger systems like reservoirs or river systems? And having worked on all of these, how is management between all of them?
That's a good question. I think I'll start out with the basic chat that I have with my fisheries management students at 8:00 in the morning every Tuesday and Thursday, is that I get that question a lot. Nick, I would say, and Jacob, I would say that really how we manage fish populations, regardless if we're managing a small mud puddle that has a bass and bluegills in it, maybe it's a quarter acre, all the way up to something like the ocean, I think the basic premise for fisheries management is the same. And how we as management biologists, how we tackle managing these systems is almost exactly the same. You still have to look at recruitment, growth, mortality in all those environments, regardless of their size, regardless of what they look like, because the dynamic rate functions is where the rubber meets the road in fisheries management. So would I say that there's differences? There are differences, but the differences are subtle when you take a step back and look at the big picture.
In your opinion, what are some of the hurdles that biologists might experience when trying to manage a population?
I think the biggest hurdle that biologists are going to have to deal with is making change happen. It's very hard for our constituents and our administrators that, you know, supervise us to allow changes to happen. I'm not going to elaborate on that a lot. So Jacob, I apologize for that, but I think that it could be political pressures. It could be a constituency base, some part of the stakeholder group. Those are generally the biggest hurdles. And if any fisheries management biologist disagrees with me on that, I would certainly love to have a phone call with you. Maybe Nick could put my phone number up there.
Certainly, I can do that. If you would like to get a hold of Quentin, you can email him at quentin.phelps@mail.wvu.edu. Or you could just Google Quentin Phelps, and he's usually the first thing to pop up. That concludes the first half of my interview with Dr. Quentin Phelps. In the second part, we discuss invasive carps. Why are they so invasive? Why are they so hard to get rid of? And why won't people eat them? We also play a fun game with my brother and Quentin to determine who the real expert is. And I ask Quentin the final five questions. You can find that episode wherever you found this one. On the website, www.thefisheriespodcast.com, or on any of your favorite podcast apps, such as Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, or the Podbean app. You can reach the podcast on any of the social media platforms, Twitter at Fisheries Pod, Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or you can email me at feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I would love to hear from you, so if you have any feedback, questions, comments, concerns, or if you would like to hear about a topic or have me interview a certain person, just reach out to me and let me know. Don't forget to check out the second half of my interview with Dr. Quentin Phelps. I am Nick Kramer. And thank you for joining me for the second episode of the Fisheries Podcast.